Accession number 22673, Wheel 7.
Tom Wade, Wheel 7.
Thank you.
So you're going to Japan?
So McNaughton and I and six musicians, all Loyal's regiment band musicians, and one Royal Artillery Sergeant Major, who's a good violinist, are going to Japan. So one day we were only given 36 hours notice. We quickly pack, do some swapping again, and of books and this and that and clothing. And one morning we march out of our camp, salute our colonel on the way out. We normally weren't allowed to salute our colonel, but we just did it on this day. And as always, when troops were actually leaving, they simply did it, and the Japanese didn't take any steps against us for that. And went out, got into a vehicle, drove to the railway station, went by train with a Japanese officer and three men. Big guard for that small number of prisoners. And went right down to Busan, where we went on board a big ferry boat, which goes across 110 or 20 miles or so of sea to Japan from Korea. And we crossed, and we noted that there was an aircraft patrol overhead, and there was a destroyer came. At around the midpoint, a destroyer was available and watched the vessels pass in each direction. And then we landed in Japan at Shimonoseki, which is the main port on the very tip of Honshu, the main island of Japan. Got on a train there and went again through the night towards Tokyo. When we arrived, we were handed over by our Japanese guard from Korea and this officer to two Japanese sergeants from Tokyo. And they were rather comic to see. One was 6 feet tall and spoke English with an English sort of accent, and the other was about 5 foot one and spoke English with an American accent, very strong American accent. And as soon as he started to talk, Jack McNaughton and I turned to each other and we both said at the same time, he sounds like Rochester. Rochester, well known to us, was the sidekick of Jack Benny on all his radio shows and on the screen too. So, and we both knew that. So we found him very funny with his gravelly voice. It's very like an American black. So we had these two strange guards. And they were very slack. When we got to one station in Tokyo, I think it was Tokyo itself, they just said, all right, you stay here. We got to go and go to an office and do something. And they went off and had a meal and left us sitting there amongst the ordinary citizens of Tokyo in Tokyo Station. So we sat there with schoolboys in sailor suits and schoolgirls in sailor suits and women in kimonos and children playing on the tiled flooring and so on, for 40 minutes before they came back. It was really strange. But I suppose the Japanese really had the idea that no foreigner's going to escape in Japan and get very far. And we really felt that too. So we didn't even prospect at all about trying to escape in Tokyo center. Tokyo railway station in the center of Tokyo. No thanks. So then they came back, and we went in a minor train, a small electric train, on to the suburb. The suburb was called Omori, O-M-O-R-I, Omori, which is a well-known suburb for geisha houses in feast time. But this was all gone. We saw a big building as we walked out towards the camp from the train, and I said, what's that? Is that a restaurant? It's a big, fine building, lovely roof on it. And they said, oh, no, geisha house normally, but all geishas doing war work now, not so busy now. So we carried on walking a little further and crossed a rickety bridge, bamboo bridge, across to an island, which was a man-made piece of restored land, which was part of the business, the early business of reclaiming parts of Tokyo Bay, which is huge, into industrial areas, which they planned. And so we went onto this sandbank, which was only just wide enough to hold this camp at one end. It was a sandbank, quite long, but at the top end, the north end where we were, it was just 5 yards wider than the camp we were going into, was about 70 yards wide and 120 yards long, maybe less, 110 yards long by 70 yards wide. Yeah, something like that. And it was Tokyo headquarter camp, Tokyo number one headquarter camp, and known as Omori because that was the neighboring district. And that's where we landed. Walking in there at night, we were led into an office, and in came what appeared to be an American flyer in leather jacket, and he said, "Hey, Richard Rochester, what are you going to do? When are you going to let these guys go?" So we knew we were among Americans, and this fellow was called Rochester, which is what we'd already called him. And then he said, "Oh, soon, 1-2 minutes." And then in came a Japanese officer in all uniform but no boots, so he's in slippers on stocking feet above with the breeches, riding breeches above. And he's picking his teeth and so on, and he said, "You sign no escape clause." He threw interpreters. He said, "Sign this no escape clause." And we said, "We signed it already." And he said, "Just sign again or something." I think we signed it. And then gave it to them. And then he said, "All right, you can go. You can go." And he went. And then we went to, taken by the Americans, officer, he turned out to be, to a spare hut where somebody had laid out blankets, which we could sleep in that night, and we were given a quick meal of rice rice and what? Anyway, doesn't matter. We were given a little meal, slightly different food from Keijo, from Korea. We had a meal and we went to bed. And the next morning, we're up with the usual bugle call early morning and tumble out of bed and quickly dress. You have to, as in Korea, you have to get out of bed, get dressed, and fold your blankets up neatly, very neatly, as in an army inspection anywhere. All four blankets neatly filed. And then be on parade all within about 2 minutes, not less, by which time the officer, the orderly officer, Japanese, would come down the road from his office and would begin the inspection. So we stood out on this little yard, this about the size of a tennis court, a bit less than a tennis court, but squared a bit more, and which was the parade ground for this small camp, all within wooden walls, tall wooden walls, and a big gate at the front. And we stood on that parade ground, and then the senior American officer appeared with other officers, some bearded, some Navy, some Army, some Air Corps, and a few British sailors visible, British petty officers visible amongst the crowd. And the American officer suddenly says, "Ni choko shokan dona ni kerei. To the duty officer, salute," in Japanese. Everything was done in Japanese. Everybody had to learn that much Japanese. Nishoko shikan dono ni karei. To the Japanese duty officer, salute. And we didn't know what to do. We just sort of looked around and followed everybody else. Kashira naka. Kashira naka. Kashira means the head or the glance or the eyes. Naka, center. So you all look towards the center where the Japanese officer is standing. And the senior officer salutes, the Japanese officer salutes back, and then begins an inspection. And each officer in charge, or each corporal, or whoever it is, in charge of each little group of men, reports in Japanese. Genzaien, Nijuhachi men, Soen, Sanju men, Nihan, Nisen, and so on. You report total number, number sick, number excused, number number somewhere else, a number on duty, and result, minimum, result, so and so. And the Japanese officer listened to all this, and you count, the men count off then. Number, the number down, 1, 2, 3, 4, in Japanese. Of course, everybody had to learn this, of course. We started this in Korea, I'd forgotten. We numbered off always in Japanese. So every single soldier knew how to count up to 100 after a while, though they rarely have to go above 40s and 50s. So we counted off in Japanese. And then the Japanese officer went. That was the end of that parade. The men went back to their huts to have breakfast, which came along in buckets, wooden buckets, with the soup in one and rice in another couple. And this was spread out into little bowls. The bowls in Korea had been aluminium bowls, ordinary soup bowl size. And the ones in Japan, in this camp, were all china, with a little star on the side to show it was Japanese army property. So we had china bowls, which was rather pleasanter than scraping than aluminium all the time. And right. So we ate the breakfast, and all the men hurry eating their breakfast and putting on their boots, because they went on parade wearing clogs, all went on wearing Japanese clogs. But coming back in after breakfast, they'd put on their boots to go to work on the job, which were all, we understood, docks and railway yards. We knew that we didn't have to do that. So they went on parade again and marched out in groups on their jobs, accompanied by guards, sentries, each with a bayoneted rifle, and the workmen, foremen from the job, who were in also dressed in sort of khaki, a softer khaki cap on, which was the national dress of Japan during wartime. Every single person who they could was dressed like that, in khaki, with a khaki hat, cap, same little cap as the army, and often carrying a wooden symbolic sword too, to show their rank as a foreman. So we found it quite comic to see all these wooden swords around. So they walked off to the job, and there we were in camp. So immediately in camp, everybody rushed around to see who these new people were and asked them questions. So we were surrounded now by perhaps 50 officers and from all over the place. And they asked us who we were. First of all, they asked us, what was your peacetime job? And Jack said, actor. And I said, newspaper reporter. And so on, went on to others too. And everybody groaned. The camp, and then we learned that the camp was full of, was not full, but we had a great many newspaper men, journalists, actors, broadcasters, concentrated there in the last few weeks in order to find men to work with Radio Tokyo in a camp which would be broadcasting in English to the American forces and to the world, really, to the world at large, from Japan, from Tokyo. So that's what they'd wanted us for. Not long after this came our interviews with the people who wanted us, who'd asked for all of us to be there. Of course, going to interviews, you go in and you learn something from the people who've been in earlier. So I learned quite a lot from that. I was very, very, very wary and very worried about this. I thought, you know, with heavy pressure, it might be very easy to be caught in their grip, to be in their grip and be forced roughly towards disloyalty by having to broadcast for them their news or their versions of the events. So this worried me a lot. But then we heard, funny enough, we heard then there were three Americans there one was a suspect of having given away prisoners suffering, some prisoners suffering to the Japanese somehow, and got the man, sick person, and got him killed in the end, got him executed. And so he was anathema to the other Americans, this one man, a sergeant. And then there were two more at least, maybe three more, who were journalists, who were very anti-Roosevelt. And the Japanese had played on this very easily. They'd asked them to write a bit of anti-Roosevelt stuff. And these Americans from small newspapers, I suppose, in Midwest or somewhere, all over the West, had not grasped that writing anti-Roosevelt articles was anti-American when you're in prison camp. And they played along with it. They did this. Their names were known. All these names were anathema to everybody else around, you know. the names were known, and they were tried after the war, these two journalists who were anti-Roosevelt, and also this sergeant. This sergeant had he was very strange. He was a tall, blonde, good-looking, broad-shouldered chap who'd gone to Japan a few years before the war and become a Buddhist priest and was very pro-Japanese in many ways. And he had cooperated with the Japanese officers in the Philippines and led, we thought, to this man's death. And so he was hated and feared by all the Americans. And after the war, long after the war, several years after the war, he was tried in an American court and eventually got off. They couldn't prove enough against him in a court in California, and he got off. I knew his name was Provo, P-R-O-V-O-O. And he got away with it. He may not have done as much harm in this camp at Radio Tokyo as killing somebody, anything like that, nothing like that. He may have only read things. You've been a voice. He may have been nothing more than a voice. He may not have been much of a writer. The journalists and people did more of the writing. And Jack McNaughton, my actor comrade, brother officer, he was kept by the Japanese and sent to this camp. But he was excused after the war by the our command, simply because they knew it was all force. It was force only that had caused these people to do all this. And same with a young American officer was there, an American naval junior lieutenant, J.G., and he also was excused for the same reason. The American Navy realized that he couldn't help it. He was the pressure being great. But anyway, the interview, I haven't come to my own interview. But my interview came after I'd heard this about the American journalists and the story about the American sergeant who was supposed to have killed a man. And Jack McNaughton had been, and he came out and said, I don't know. He just wouldn't say very much about how he experienced. I didn't learn much from him. Then I went into my interview, and there were three Japanese conducting it. One sitting dead center, who was, I understood, the Marquis Ikeda, who'd Oxford educated and a diplomat. And over on one side was the head of the Army Press Bureau, and the other side was another Japanese journalist type in the army. And They interviewed us to see if we were suitable. And they asked me if I was... they said, you worked on a newspaper in Shanghai, didn't you, Mr. Wade? He told me Mr. Wade in this place. I said, yes. And have you been in Japan before? Yes. Only 5 days. 5 days? Why 5 days? Why only 5 days? I said, well, I was on ship, and it just called at Yokohama and Kobe and so on. And they said, oh, yes. And then they said, would you like to learn more about Japan and Japanese culture? And I said, there's not much evidence about Japanese culture here. And they said, no, this is a prison camp, but outside you would be much more suitable place for studying Japanese life and ways. And I said, and they let that go. My hmm was enough, I think. And then they said, after about another one more question, they said, what do you think of the Japanese, Mr. Wade? And I said, well, I really let them go then. I said, the Japanese are the Prussians of Asia. They are highly emotional, but also militaristic, something like this, I said, militaristic and highly emotional, and it's a they're different and they're dangerous to us because no, I didn't say they're dangerous. They're not to us. They're dangerous because of this mixture, this quality. They are aggressive and militaristic, and they've given the army much too much power. And a little more than that, I said. And then they said, they thought about it, they looked at each other and made little signs and so on. And the Ven says, all right, Mr. Wade, you can go. And I was relieved. I was released from the interview. They didn't take me. They took Mike Norton, the young American I got to know quite well in a few days, and none of the musicians. Kind of a mixed bag. One Australian who hadn't been a journalist, whereas another an Australian journalist was refused, and so on. And we knew that quite a well-known Australian broadcaster called Cousins, had been accepted already by the Japanese and was at their headquarters and occasionally having to read news and write news or read news for the Japanese towards the Australians, Australia and the Australian troops in the Far East. So I was relieved, I wasn't on that. So I went back to camp and I was now just an ordinary officer prisoner of war in Tokyo. I was immediately put in charge of one of the five barrack huts. There were only five barrack huts. And I was put in command of the smallest one. We were all second lieutenants, by the way. Second lieutenants and lieutenants had command of all these cuts. All the majors and captains and lieutenant commanders and commanders and so on, all took no jobs of their own, took no jobs for themselves. They gave this work to the youngest officers and they stayed free of that kind of work. I note this because, as I noted in my book, because I don't think it's all that admirable, and I don't think it's very fair either, because some officers were as young as 20 and were straight from a flying school or straight from a camp and had no knowledge of the Japanese, no knowledge of the Far East, no knowledge of anything, and they were stuck in these sort of situations. Still, they were officers, and they had, for some months anyway, been in command of men. But still is not very fair, not very admirable. And so I was in command of this hut. It only had 40 or 50 men in the first, the odds-sods of the odds and sods who arrived recently. Some of them were the people who had been brought up for these interviews. Some of them were just men passing through, because Tokyo being a headquarter camp, men occasionally pass through from ship to this camp to another camp somewhere else, or from one camp to another camp via Tokyo. And which also meant that Tokyo was a good clearinghouse for information among prisoners of war. We learned quite a lot about other camps from these movements. And that was a good thing, being a journalist. I mean, I was quite glad to be in the center of what little news there was. A little later, more men arrived from other camps, and in a short time, I had 110 men in my barrack hut, Japanese barrack hut, and so were the other five. Five huts, each with about 100, 105 men. These huts were about 100 feet long and 18 feet wide, and just two layers on each side of raised platform on which to sleep and keep your kit. Each man had about the width of his shoulders, a little more, to sleep on before the next man, and to keep his blankets folded, and all his clothes were kept on a shelf above his head, only about 16 or 17 inches wide, each man. And everything of his had been kept up there except for boots, which were in the underneath the edge of the ledge that he was sitting, that he slept on. There were little ladders up to the upper deck in each hut. So the huts were very economical and very suitable for Japanese style of living. And that's what they had in most camps if they didn't have permanent buildings available. So I was in charge of this hut. had to keep control, and certain interpreters were rather bullies in this camp at headquarter camp, and if they hit one of the men, they sometimes came and hit you too, because you were barrack commander, you should know better, or you should control the man better, or you should tell him his rule the rules better, or you should discipline him better or something. There are all sorts of reasons why you should they should not break the rules, and you should have been you were responsible for it, so they could come and hit you too.
With fists?
Yeah, with open hand or with fists, yes. More often with open hand, I think, than with fists, on the whole. But punches in the body were with close fists. And kicks were common, and hitting with sticks or bayonets, if they had a bayonet, they'd hit you with the side of the bayonet, or with a rifle butt sometimes, not too hard with a rifle, with a rifle butt, and with their boots and their fists. So there I was there, and I immediately then started to see what was happening in this camp and what I could do usefully there. And about the next day, along came a tall British officer called Major Frankham, and he said, here are 8 letters for you. And I realized that, and he told me that we have a post office in this camp, and we run a post office, and these are all for you. They've been arriving over the last months. And so Major Frankham handed me 8 letters from my mother and sister and father from around the world. My mother and sister were now in San Francisco. My father was in Japanese prison camp for civilians in China, North China, where he'd been in Tientsin. And this was in North China still. And they were all well. I was glad to read that, very glad to read that. And then I asked to see his post office. He said, sure, come and work in it. And I went into the post office, which was the front half of one of these huts, separated by the new wall, and went in. There were about 6 officers and a couple of petty officers sitting at tables and seats with make-do tables and make-do shelves in front of them, trying to sort letters. And there were bags of letters, bags, I forgot what they were made of now. I keep thinking, I see them now as black plastic bags, but I'm not sure they were at the time. They were some kind of bags. They weren't English mail bags of that period, which were heavy, canvassy things. They were something lighter. I think they might have been plastic. The Japanese might have got onto that first. They might have been plastic bags. And there were letters there, and these fellows were sifting them. There were all kinds of letters. I mean, in those days, English letters tended to come in small square envelopes, medium-sized envelopes, long envelopes, tall envelopes, everything. American letters all came in exactly the same kind of standard envelope, which we all use now. So theirs were damn easy to deal with. Ours were extraordinarily difficult to deal with properly. And the Americans who worked in the post office say, why don't you goddamn British ever get to a simple, large envelope like everybody else does? And we'd say, oh, people up north, they haven't got much money, and they buy little envelopes this size and small pads of paper and so on and so on. And they think we're crazy. But we got on very, very well with the Americans most of the time, especially the more intelligent. That meant the officers and senior NCOs and that, more so than perhaps the men. But also we got on very well with certain types of among the men too. I mean, not with the most stupid. You never got on with the people who were the most xenophobic or the most anti-foreign and the most uneducated. They were a loss. You could do very little with them, you know. They never understood your explanation. They never understood what the Japanese meant. They never understood your explanation of why the Japanese were doing it, and there might have been a good reason. They never understood that. They just stayed on being bluntly anti-Japanese, somewhat anti-American, somewhat anti-Australian, somewhat anti-Dutch, somewhat anti-everybody, you know,
flexible
and not in any way cosmopolitan by any means. What they did have, though, was guts and humor and willingness to do the job and help each other out a bit and stick together and survive. They had the qualities to survive, most of them, more so than the often slimmer, weedier intellectual types who more often succumbed to starvation and disease. They were tough. The Americans had a reputation then, very strong, thanks to movies and their own propaganda, that they were very, very tough people. But in prison camp, many of the American officers admitted